Hello, I'm Cynthia Schuster filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Earlier this year, President Obama surprised many during his State of the Union address when he made a call for a universal child care system.
You know, study after study shows that the sooner a child begins learning, the better he or she does down the road. But today, fewer than 3 in 10 four-year-olds are enrolled in a high-quality preschool program. Most middle-class parents can't afford a few hundred bucks a week for a private preschool. And for poor kids who need help the most, this lack of access to preschool education can shadow them for the rest of their lives. Tonight, I propose working with states to make high-quality preschool available to every single child in America.
Well, nevertheless, this plan hasn't really gotten off the ground, but our guest this hour wonders if this is the big moment for better work-family balance policies. And we hope to hear from you this hour. Would you benefit from something like a universal preschool system, or is something like that too much of a fiscal burden at this time? Are you a struggling parent trying to maintain a healthy work-life balance but need some help with childcare? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or share a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Our guest is Bryce Covert. She writes for The Nation on women and business issues. Bryce, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we talk further about President Obama's vision for universal health care, or child care, rather, let's take a look a little bit in the past. This sounds like something similar to what the Congress was floating in 1971.
Absolutely. We saw this happen about 40 years ago when a bipartisan bill was put forward and actually passed on a bipartisan vote in Congress that would have been the first step toward a universal child care system. And it looked a lot like what President Obama talked about in his State of the Union. It was very focused on quality educational programming for children, as well as focusing on the fact that it would also free up women and men as well to go into the workforce and get to their jobs. It was a very bipartisan idea at the time, and then we saw the beginning of the culture wars and the rise of the evangelical right, and they started a very intense campaign against it. They also had Pat Buchanan, who was in the White House, who was able to sort of whisper into Nixon's ear about how terrible this was, and Nixon ended up vetoing it and saying some very sort of ominous and dark things about it that sound a lot like the culture war that we saw after, you know, government intruding in the private family, going where it shouldn't. And the idea has been mostly dormant since then until this year.
And what was the impetus for making this call this year?
I've been asking myself that a lot. You know, I've been thinking about and writing about issues like affordable, accessible child care for a long time, and it's not an issue that anyone seemed like they were interested in taking up, Democrat or Republican. I think, though, that there's something happening right now in the country where this issue of work-family balance, of having an affordable, quality place to put your kids when you go to work, paid family leave, paid sick days, is really starting to have its moment in the spotlight. And you can see it in sort of the cultural conversation with things like Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In and Anne-Marie Slaughter's, you know, Have It All article. But you also see it now in politics. There was Obama's proposal. The Republicans, interestingly, tried to get in on it with a bill that probably wouldn't have really helped that much, but they called it the Working Families Flexibility Act, trying to get in on the work-family debate. Now, the most recent thing we saw was Nancy Pelosi introducing this new economic agenda for women and families, which is a very comprehensive package of policies that would help working women as well as working men, that includes universal child care. And I think that it's just become something that people feel can't be ignored anymore. Families, now they know that it takes two incomes to get by. The recession really taught us that, but I think they probably knew that before the recession happened. And it's hard to do that when you don't know where to put your kids when you go off to your job. So this has become something that I think has become a lot less controversial than the 70s.
And do we know what the financial impact would be for a family that would like to enroll their child in something like a universal preschool system, I guess both out-of-pocket expenses and in the way of tax increases and that sort of thing?
Well, we do know that child care costs in this country are extremely high. They exceed median rent in all 50 states. Some of them cost as much as sending your kid to a public university for 4 years. So the costs have gotten really out of control. We also don't spend as much as other countries on giving parents some support to try and defray those costs. And actually, the support that we do give from federal government money has been declining in recent years. So parents are getting less help as the costs keep rising. And if you have something that is universally accessible and affordable, you know, Obama's plan, at least at first, would be on a sliding scale, but it would be in the hopes that everyone could afford it out of their budgets. That means that cost no longer eats so heavily into people's incomes.
Well, let's talk about Nancy Pelosi's plan, the economic agenda for women and families. Can you explain what that is more specifically?
Sure. So what she has done, and she introduced this with Representative DeLauro and some other House Republican women, is to basically take a bunch of policies, most of which will look familiar, a minimum wage hike, paid family leave, paid sick days, the Paycheck Fairness Act, which they've introduced a lot to address wage inequality, and put them under this single umbrella. And they've done it by both pointing out the problems and then offering these solutions as a way to really plant a flag in the work-family debate as Democrats who are looking to help working families. I talked to her this week, actually, and sort of said, you know, why now and why put them all together like this since you've been working on these issues for some time? And she basically said, I've been going around the country talking to women, and I hear over and over again that this issue weighs the most heavily on their minds, but that they also don't think that there's anyone out there who is fighting for these policies. They don't see a path in Congress towards better work family policies. And she's hoping to say to them, look, there's a path. I've picked a fight on this issue, and I'm going to keep fighting on this issue. And she says she's going to keep fighting it until things pass. The challenge, of course, will be it's a very broad package of proposals, and some of them will be easier than others. And she admitted herself that universal child care, is going to be the biggest, as she says, bite of the apple. It's going to be a challenge. You know, the culture wars are going to war back again against this. They may fall on deaf ears in American households who really are yearning for affordable child care, but that's going to happen again. But I think that it's really fascinating to see Democrats take up this fight in a very vocal way, in a way that they really haven't for a while now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that she has decided to sort of like bundle all these up in one umbrella. We had just talked earlier today with a guest about immigration reform and why one proposal has passed through the Senate, but the same can't be done in the House. And our guest had speculated or said that one of the reasons was because the House wanted to not do a comprehensive bill, but consider all of the factors individually. Do you think that the House will have the same response to Nancy Pelosi's proposal?
Absolutely. I think that that's going to be the first challenge that she faces, is that people are going to want to pick things off out of this. A lot of people in the House are not going to have the stomach for this entire package all at once. Obviously, the people who are standing with her are ready for it, but I think it will take some time until something as comprehensive as this could actually move forward. I don't know how she feels about picking it off. I would guess that if she could get pieces of this passed, that would be an achievement, because a lot of these she's been pushing on for some time. I think the point of putting them into a comprehensive package like this is to make it visible to everyday Americans who aren't watching the deal making on Capitol Hill every day, moment by moment, and to say, this is an issue I'm taking up, whether or not she passes the whole thing at once.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Bryce Covert. She writes for The Nation on women and business issues, and we're talking about the Paycheck Fairness Act, the economic agenda for women and families, the work Working Families Flexibility Act. So many proposals on the table are at least being talked about in terms of fostering what some hope will bring along more support for working families and for parents who are struggling to find childcare that's affordable as they try to also make a living and keep up with the cost of living. Does this resonate with you? Are you a parent that's struggling to make ends meet? And would something like this help you? On the other hand, are you concerned that a universal childcare system might be too much of a fiscal burden at this time in our economy? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Bryce, you say the president tabled a bill that would guarantee paid sick leave back in his first term. And even the first lady backed away from the chance to bring these issues to the forefront as she does her thing around the country. But why are they distancing them? Why are the Obamas distancing themselves from this issue?
I think when they started this first term, these issues were still considered to be hot button, that they would bring a lot of blowback really quickly. I think Michelle Obama had a real appetite for it from what we've heard, but she was directed towards things that are more or less controversial, you know, and important, but veterans' rights, childhood obesity. She seems to be stepping out a little bit more. I don't know if this is going to come back on her radar. And when it comes to pay equity, you know, Obama has really been out there on this. It was the first bill he signed when he signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which was a small step forward towards pay equity. I think that issue hasn't been as controversial. But when it comes to something like universal child care, it will cost money up front. There's really no question about that. I think the research is pretty solid that we get huge dividends from investing in it in the future, but that's an investment you have to make, and there's not necessarily the appetite for that. And I think when you start to talk about, you know, paid leave and paid sick days, there's always a side that brings up small businesses and talks about it like it's a burden, even though there's lots of research that shows that it's actually quite good for businesses in terms of productivity and turnover. But those are battle lines that I think that they were wary of crossing, at least in the first term. But now we're in the second term, and, you know, Obama surprised at least me, and I think a lot of other people, by putting forward universal child care. So, you know, he may have more room to run on that. But I also think, you know, as I said before, these issues have actually become less controversial for the everyday American and much more common sense. Mm-hmm. And they're just sort of being part of that.
But at the same time, and maybe I'm comparing this improperly in my head, but when I hear universal child care, I also hear, I put it akin to universal health care. And I think about how nearly 40 times now the Affordable Health Care Act has been voted on in terms of pretty much striking it down in attempts to do that. So what is telling the president that now's the time to get serious about proposing this when the Affordable Care Act is still being fought over to this day?
Well, it's definitely being fought over, but it's also the law of the land. You know, he got that law through Congress, and then it survived a constitutional challenge at the Supreme Court. And I think that that's a pretty solid validation of that law. You know, I'm sure that this will be just as strong a fight as that bill was if it actually goes forward. But I also think both Obama's proposal and Pelosi's proposals aren't necessarily about passing something right now, although, of course, I would love to see that happen. I think they're more about putting down markers and saying, these are priorities for the Democratic Party. You might not have realized that these are things that we fight for and care about, but hopefully now you do. And we may not pass it now, but, you know, 10 years, 15 years, maybe even just 5 years down the line, that will have become so normalized in the debate that it will become much more realistic further down, because we have gotten comfortable with the idea. It's been sort of injected into the national conversation. So, you know, I'd personally be pretty shocked to see Obama really push this forward, although he may, because I think it's smart policy. But I think even more important, perhaps, is just getting this conversation started. Mm-hmm.
That's Bryce Covert. She writes for The Nation on the issues pertaining to women in business and We're talking about various proposals, bills, and other ideas being floated around in Washington regarding work-life balance issues, childcare costs, and living wages. I'm Cynthia Schuster filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and we invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and we're talking with Bryce Covert. She writes for The Nation on women and business issues, and we're talking about various proposals and ideas put forth in Washington regarding work-life balance and support for child care, specifically the idea of beginning a universal child care system. And Bryce, we talked about some of the other proposals, including Nancy Pelosi's economic agenda for women and families. But you had also mentioned earlier the Working Families Flexibility Act. And you didn't endorse it, let's say. What were people expecting from the Working Families Flexibility Act? And what does the act actually promise?
The name would sound like this was a Republican-sponsored bill, so that Republicans were trying to make life easier for working Americans by giving people more flexibility about their hours so that, you know, you could take a little time here, a little time there to be with a sick child, to take them to school, you know, whatever it is you need to get done. In practice, that's not really what it would end up doing. What it really did was give employers the option of letting workers take comp time instead of overtime pay, as they are mandated to do by law under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And workers could then use that comp time. So it's not really guaranteeing you paid time off. It's just letting you sort of swap paid overtime for unpaid time off. And the troubling thing about their bill, particularly, I think, was that it didn't have a lot of checks on employers' power. So employers, in theory, could just push their workers into this option, and workers would not have a whole lot of choice about it. And then employers were allowed to decide whether or not a worker was actually allowed to take that time off when they put in the request, which could end up being a pretty bad deal for a lot of workers. And we definitely know from other laws that there's a lot of employer abuse when it comes to things like overtime pay. So it was not necessarily a bill that would have actually helped working families. But what I thought was fascinating about it, even though it's a somewhat old idea that they've resurfaced a couple times, is that it really felt like the Republicans were trying to enter the work-family debate. They kept talking about how families need to go to work and they need flexibility to also raise their children, and it's hard to raise your children in this economy, which is a different tack than sort of the more traditional family, women should stay home and men should go to work, that we usually see them talk about. Not that that died, but this was a policy proposal that was trying to take into account the fact that our families look very different than they did in, say, the 1960s. You know, again, I'm skeptical of the bill itself, but was intrigued to see the Republicans jump in on this debate.
1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join our conversation. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's talk to Don in Madison. Hi, Don.
Hello, this is John.
Hi, John. What's your question?
Just a couple of comments. I did my doctoral work in curriculum and lectured on four continents, and I think there's some lessons to be learned about the preschool years from other places. I think Quebec went off in a different route than the rest of Canada, and we learned that having the mother or another family member nurture the child from ages 1 to 2 is really important. Otherwise, around third grade, at least one study shows that the legs start lagging behind those who have that kind of family background. However, a favorite system of mine, which is explained very clearly in Finnish lessons by Pasi Salberg, shows that there, where they have no formal schooling until age 7 and provide preschool from ages 3 through 6, the results are spectacular. The nation often ranks number 1 or 2 in math, reading, and, of course, the nation as a whole is doing very well with productivity, happiness, life expectancy, and so forth. So I think, how do you pay for that? And I think that's a legitimate question, since Finland also does that with less pay to teachers, though they give their teachers a free ride with along with everyone else. They get post-secondary schooling free, and they're required to have a master's. And I think the way to perhaps do that is to see if we could end school 1 or 2 years earlier at the age of 16 or 17 and bring that money forward into the system. And children mature sooner biologically these days. A lot of students end up doing AP courses in their last 2 years of high school. So I think I personally am trying to circulate Posse's book among thought leaders in education in Wisconsin, and I'm hoping we could go the route of doing what they did, was reform after World War II, adopt much of the Swedish system, pull in some of the best ideas from the USA, and put equity at the forefront of what they're trying to do with education.
Thanks for that call, John. And Bryce, what do you think of that?
Well, I think that the upfront cost is definitely, you know, as I said before, one of the challenges of doing universal child care or universal preschool. The research is very clear that we get huge payoff for that investment later in terms of, you know, more productive workers, fewer people relying on public assistance when they grow up, paying more taxes because their earnings are higher. But you do have to make that upfront investment. What Obama has done is to propose a higher tax on tobacco products, which, you know, as he says, has the dual impact of funding preschool as well as hopefully discouraging smoking. I don't know if that's the best solution, but I do think there are creative ways. I'm not sure the U.S. should be pulling back on education. I still think we need to be investing more. We fall behind on a lot of educational markers around the world. But I think that there are probably creative ways we can do it. I don't know if there's the stomach for it, but I think it could be done if that's something we could really commit ourselves to.
If you were to pick, I guess, the best practices from different countries around the world, what systems would you look at and what would you like to see implemented here in the United States?
That's a big question. A lot of other countries do better than we do for work-family balance, I should say, at the beginning. We are an extreme outlier when it comes to things like not offering paid maternity leave, not guaranteeing paid sick days off. So there's a lot of options to choose from, I guess I would say. France has a really interesting program for childcare where you basically have an option of subsidized very high quality child care from basically age zero until, you know, regular schooling at what would be kindergarten. They are also very high quality. The people in the I think they're called creches, are college trained teachers basically, you know, and the caller mentioned teacher pay. I think that another part of Obama's proposal that's really important is making sure that we are paying people who are in either the child care centers or teaching preschool well enough that it raises the status of the profession, that we invest in them so that they're well-trained, that this becomes a real profession and career in a way that it's not right now. We do not pay preschool teachers nearly as much as other teachers, and we don't pay other teachers that much either. So France is one. Finland is a place everybody looks. They have a very good system for paid time off. That includes men, which I think is really important. You know, if you include men in paid family leave, and also make sure that it's mandatory that they take some paid family leave, they take much more leave and end up really bonding with their children, and it's a very powerful way to make it more equitable. Hmm. So I think there's a lot to choose from. The U.S. has a long way to go, though, so even if we're taking baby steps towards any of those programs, I think we're making progress.
Well, John had mentioned some concern over how to pay for a new system, and I guess was trying to figure out what a good way to pay for that would be. And not necessarily that there's any answers out there yet, but President Obama had laid out in his State of the Union speech sort of a cost-benefit analysis. Let's take a listen.
Every dollar we invest in high-quality early childhood education can save more than $7 later on by boosting graduation rates, reducing teen pregnancy, even reducing violent crime. In states that make it a priority to educate our youngest children, like Georgia or Oklahoma, studies show students grow up more likely to read and do math at grade level, graduate high school, hold a job, form more stable families of their own. We know this works. So let's do what works and make sure none of our children start the race of life already behind. Let's give our kids that chance.
Bryce Covert, how do you feel about that?
The research really backs him up there. There's really solid research looking at the impact of providing affordable or free, accessible preschool to particularly low-income families, but all families, and the benefits that it has later. As he says, it reduces crime. It raises their earnings later on. It prepares them for school. It's really beneficial, and the dividends are like $11 for every dollar we spend. It's delayed, but we see that come back in societal and economic benefits. The other part that he doesn't talk about as much, though, is the way that this ends up impacting working mothers, because this, and fathers, but mostly mothers who are usually the ones burdened with the caring responsibilities, having universal preschool or child care really frees them up, and it increases their earnings. It decreases the costs they have to lay out. It makes them less likely to rely on public assistance. So we also see dividends happening there, where from women who are able to enter the workforce and make more money and care for their families better, which he doesn't mention as often, but should also be part of the cost-benefit analysis when we're looking at the policy. Mm-hmm.
1-800-642-1234 is our phone number. If you have any questions or thoughts on this issue, that's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. We'll talk to Helen next in New Glarus. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I struggle with work-life balance all the time. I was raising my four kids. And a couple of things just keep niggling at me. One of them is, the two monoliths that we deal with are business, the private sector, and public education. Where is it written that they have to have totally uncoordinated schedules? Why does school end 2 hours before I get home from work? Why do I have to get a child care provider for the half an hour to an hour and a half in the morning? I mean, I think the push should be on employers to create more family-friendly policies, and not that they niggle away at the money all the time, but if they want good employees who aren't distracted, aren't worried about their kids, they ought to be thinking about schedules that make sense for families. Now, I know this is dealing with families with kids in school mainly, but it just seems to me that none of this is written in stone. The time of the school day, the work day has changed historically in this country for many, many times and many years. So I don't know why we don't push on employers and on business and on the school districts to work together to make it so that the family doesn't always feel so fractured. And where is it written that you can't have an hour and a half for lunch so you can go see your kids?
Hmm.
So I think, you know, we're all saying the given is you have the industry that has to have this certain work day. The school has to have this particular schedule. I don't think so. I think we could do something better.
Well, Helen, I have a question for you. Who yes. should make the first step in coordinating such a change?
I think the woman you're talking to right now, who seems to have a lot of political clout, could be looking at a broader picture. And if you went to industry and said you will get better employees, you'll get people who are happier, and you probably can pay a small, discount for those people who are working less than what they consider their 40-hour week, I think you might find some of the more family-friendly employers willing to at least talk about it. Because, frankly, I've employed people, and when my employees have a kid home from school and they don't know where the kid is, or the kid is a little bit sick and they're on the phone all the time, they're not very productive. So start with mm-hmm. industry. Push on them.
Thank you so much, Helen. That's an interesting point. Bryce, what are your thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree and have written elsewhere that I am a big proponent of the idea that Americans need to work less. We work longer hours than most developed countries around the world, and yet we work harder in each hour, so we are working harder and working longer than the rest of the world. And I think this is a really key part of work-family balance. I agree with her. I mean, we can talk about childcare and preschool, we can talk about paid leave, but we also have to talk about how much we're working, because if preschool gets done at 3 or 4 and you're not done working until 9 p.m., your students still don't have work-family balance. And unfortunately, I think there aren't great prospects for a movement about this, because I think the organization that would have the biggest countervailing power against business to demand shorter work weeks are unions. And unions are struggling right now with membership. It's way down historically. Not very many people, particularly in the private sector, are unionized, which means that workers have a lot less clout against their employers to push back and say, hey, we should not be working this long. You are asking too much of us.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I think about that in contrast to maybe some European countries where there aren't 40-hour work weeks and maybe there's a healthier work-life balance, so I can't cite any research. I think I've heard of some, and maybe you know of some. But I'm wondering if here in the U.S., is it likely that we could – well, no, let me put it this way. In other countries, are there any systems where the school schedules and the private business work schedules are in better sync that would foster a healthier work-life balance, or at least make it easier for parents to see their children and not have to scramble in the morning or arrange for childcare for those 2 hours in the afternoon when the children are out of school and they're not yet home from work?
Well, there are other countries who definitely do limit how the work week. They limit how many hours people can work in a much more robust way than we do. And that helps bring work hours much better in sync. They also, you know, they guarantee vacation time so that you can take vacation with your kids when your kids are on vacation. They guarantee paid sick time so that you can leave your job and go home to be with your sick kid when they can't be in school because they are running a fever. So I think that other countries do a much better job of bringing the workday in line with what kids are doing during the day.
And when we talk about Americans that are overworked and probably putting in many more than 40 hours a week, and we're also looking at high unemployment rates and people who just want a job, what are the chances that the new economy might foster a way for maybe systems like job shares, where there are more part-time jobs and fewer full-time, but therefore more people that are employed?
I think that it makes a lot of sense to look at something like that in an economy like this, as you point out, with so many people just looking for any work and other people who feel overworked. I do think, though, the down economy makes it, again, less likely that we're going to see any pressure on companies to reduce work hours. The workers who have jobs right now have so little power beyond not being unionized, because there are so many people clamoring for their job if they decide to leave. You have a lot less bargaining power with your employer when they can say, well, fine, walk, and I'm just going to hire someone else, because there's literally 50 people who have handed me their resume and want your job. So a better economy, I do actually think, would be helpful, at least, in pushing on employers to reduce work hours or to think about more flexible arrangements. And then, again, unionization would keep that momentum going. But the economy is not doing that well, and we have a long way to go until an employment level that would actually allow that to happen.
Well, and in the United States, it tends to be that if you have a part-time job, you also don't have benefits then. And so then other costs come into play, like health care and things that you have to pay for out of pocket. So is it really practical to expect that we're going to see more part-time jobs that are still sustainable in that respect?
I doubt it. As you point out, a lot of benefits are tied to being full-time. And we are also seeing right now a lot of companies making people go part-time or temporary against their will. There's a rising number of people who are working part-time jobs who want full-time work so that they can support themselves. It's also important to remember that even when women take a part-time position or ask for flexible time so that they can be with their children, they tend to get penalized for that in their wages. So while it can ease the stress that they feel between balancing trying to take care of their kids and get to their job, it's probably hurting their income. Part of that is just plain old discrimination of employers thinking of mothers as less attached to the workplace, and the fact that men are not as likely to be caretakers, so they're not as likely to ask for those arrangements. So, I don't think we can just sort of jump into part-time hours or flexible hours and expect that to be a panacea.
Hmm. Our guest is Bryce Covert. She writes for The Nation on issues pertaining to women, and to business. And we're talking about the struggle to maintain a work-life balance due in part to childcare costs and other logistical concerns. And do you wish there were a universal childcare system to utilize, or is that something that would be too much of a fiscal burden on our country at this time? You could give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. You can tweet us at KDunnShow. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Kathleen, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Bryce Covert, a writer for The Nation who covers issues pertaining to women and business. And our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. And you can also leave a comment or question on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Well, Bryce, we've been talking about some proposals and calls for action on the national level pertaining to universal child care systems and other means for helping working families, and whether or not these things actually come to pass and or have a lasting effect on the checkbooks and, I guess, logistical concerns of working class families. I'm wondering if you are starting to see some activity on the state or municipal level with regards to this issue.
Definitely. There's actually some great stuff happening at the state level and the city level right now. The fight for paid sick days has been spreading pretty quickly. New York City was the last one to adopt a paid sick leave bill, and it's now the largest city in the country that has a paid sick leave policy that will go into effect in the coming years. It joins a bunch of other cities as well as the state of Connecticut in doing that. We actually just saw, I believe it was last month, Rhode Island become the third state in the country to have a paid family leave policy go into place, joining California and New Jersey, which, you know, that's very slow progress, but it was exciting to see progress happening there. So I do think we've been seeing some action there. There's also countervailing forces, though, at the state level. There's been a rash of what are called preemption bills that are designed to block cities and municipalities and states from enacting their own paid sick leave legislation. And the biggest victory lately there was in Florida, where now in the state of Florida, even if you're a city that wants to have paid sick days, now you can't because a bill was signed into law there saying that you're blocked from doing so. And those bills have kept pace with paid sick leave legislation. So it's sort of an even fight there right now. And as I said, for paid family leave, you know, we now have three states, but that's a very slow progress that's being made. So I think there's reason to be optimistic, but it's definitely not sort of spreading like wildfire.
Hmm. Let's take a call from Tim in Fairchild. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, what's your question or comment today?
Well, since listening to it, since I turned my radio down, I guess I have several, but I've traveled into Europe and Norway and whatever, and the companies over there don't seem to be as greedy as our companies, and they're all successful financially. And I have a nephew that lives in Norway, and that happens to be my heritage. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But they get leave when a child is born, both the male and female. And in Germany, the same thing. And these companies are very successful, very financially successful. And I wonder if our corporations and the United States could take a lesson from some of the European countries and be a little bit more generous instead of being so greedy. And I guess that'd be my comment.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Any observations there?
Yeah, he makes an interesting point, which is that in the U.S., we've definitely seen profits growing really quickly for American countries, but they're leaving workers' wages behind. So workers are working more, they're more productive. Profits are soaring at a lot of American corporations, but workers have not seen their wages rise. CEOs have seen their pay go up, but not the workers. So I think that it's a solid point to make that if we raise the minimum wage, if we ask companies to pay their workers more, there is the money to do that in American corporations, and they just aren't.
Well, President Obama called to raise the minimum wage as part of his economic vision yesterday in Galesburg, Illinois. Would you agree with him that that's an important part of the equation?
Absolutely. I think it's important for workers across the board. It will have important economic benefits because low-income people spend a lot of their money on goods and services, and that money gets pumped back into the economy pretty quickly. But it's also a very important piece of fair pay for women, and it's a part of Pelosi's new women's equality agenda. Women make up two-thirds of minimum wage workers, and a raise to the minimum wage is likely to really help us narrow that wage gap between women and men. So I think it's important sort of for everyone, but particularly for women.
But what would you say to the argument, though, that raising the minimum wage is actually going to put a burden on businesses such that we actually see a net loss of jobs altogether?
There's actually lots of research that shows very little, if any, impact on companies. For the most part, the impact is neutral on businesses' bottom line. It's also neutral on job creation. And some have even found that it can boost job creation as workers are more productive, there's less turnover, so businesses see a little boost to their bottom line. And as I said, you know, you pay a worker more at the bottom of the income scale, they pump that money back into the economy, which then helps create other jobs. So I actually think that it's good for business, too.
Bryce, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I heard your phone cut out there, so I wasn't sure if we lost you. Well, let's talk a little bit, though, about the cost of childcare today, a little bit more in depth. How much does it cost an average parent to put their child in daycare right now?
It costs quite a lot of money. It can cost as much as $15,000 to put a kid in child care. As I said earlier in the show, it costs more to put your kids in child care than it does to pay the median rent in your state. So they have really skyrocketed. It is very, very expensive to put kids through daycare. It's even more expensive in some places than it costs to put them to college.
Wow. So that's, I guess, if you could approximate what a percentage of one's monthly income that is, what fraction would that be?
It depends, but we do know that low-income people are spending a huge amount of their income on this expense. I don't have the figure in front of me, but it's something very large, like a third of their income is going to this, perhaps even more, mm-hmm. depending on what you make. And, of course, you know, the price of private daycare doesn't really fluctuate depending on your income. So they end up paying a lot more and struggling really to pay for it and then get to their jobs, which allows them to make more. It's kind of a catch-22.
Well, there's an inherent cost that comes with actually just having a child, too. We were talking in the office yesterday about how much it costs to have a baby in the U.S., and one of our producers, KP Whaley, had read that giving birth in the U.S. is twice the cost of that in England, so that our births in this country are literally more expensive than the royal babies. Is that true?
It is. It's shockingly true. There was a great in-depth New York Times article that went searching for the answer to how much more do Americans pay for delivering a baby, and the costs are huge. It's about $30,000 for a sort of regular pregnancy and delivery, and that is way more than other people pay. That's thanks in large part to our healthcare system, where we tend to pay far more because we pay for each individual thing. You know, we pay for each operation and aesthetic doctor's visit separately instead of bundling them together as they do in a lot of other countries. But yeah, it costs a lot to have a child from pregnancy all the way through until they're making their own money, because college is expensive, daycare is expensive, having a baby is expensive. It's expensive to take time off once you have your baby from work because we don't have paid leave. It really is an extreme expense for a lot of people.
1-800-642-1234 if you want to get a call in here before we have to say goodbye to our guest. We've got Chris in Menasha on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. You were talking before about more part-time jobs, and I heard you mentioned job sharing. And I just thought I would share my experience. I have job shared with the same person for almost 35 years. it's been a wonderful experience. You have time to be with your family. We do share some benefits. We don't get insurance, but we do get sick leave, and we do get vacation, and we fill a full-time position, so we share the full-time positions, sick leave and vacation benefit. Mm-hmm. It's worked out wonderful, and I think that more companies should incorporate that into their plans.
So is this a 50-50 share, or how is it split?
It's 50-50. I work 2 days a week. I always work Monday, Tuesday. She works all Thursday, Fridays, and we trade off Wednesdays.
Oh, nice. Obviously the company endorses you two doing this. Is this something that your other colleagues do?
Nope. We're pretty innovative. At the time we started job sharing, I think I had heard about one other couple of gals doing it in our area. We work for a small outfit. It's an attorney's office. So I don't know how many employees, say 30, you know, mm-hmm. Office employees. And it's just been great.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your experience, Chris.
You're welcome.
And what do you think of that, Bryce? Is that a model that other companies should follow?
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. There's actually laws in a lot of other countries that protect the right, what they call the right to ask, which is the right to ask your employer for a more alternative or flexible situation, similar to the one that Chris had, or you could think of other arrangements. And we don't have that in the U.S. Workers are not protected, and it's actually sort of a wild west. You know, it's up to the employer whether they want to grant it to you, whether they feel like retaliating against you. They probably shouldn't, but I think that happens quite a lot. There is a law being considered in San Francisco, however, right now, that would mimic sort of the right to ask laws, and that would be a good way to get something like this going. And it's great to hear that she gets benefits in her job, and I think that companies are going to have to take a harder look at giving benefits to part-time workers. You know, as I was saying before, we're seeing a growing share of workers in this economy who are part-time or temporary, and it's going to be incumbent on all of us to find a way to make sure that they also have benefits, if that's sort of the new job model that we're moving toward.
Let's take a quick call from Mike in Clinton, Iowa. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I'm just calling in regards to the daycare costs, and I think employers could do a lot more. We have 80-20 insurance, and I heard the number 38,000, so I crunched in the 20% that we would have to pay is $7,600. And we couldn't even afford, my wife and I, you know, if we were to have a baby, we couldn't afford to take the baby out of the hospital. We'd have to leave him there. So, you know, we don't know what employers could do, but I really wish that, you know, people would consider, you know, how people could start off having a family and how are they really going to do it without relying on grandma and grandpa, mom and dad, cousins, uncles. I don't know how people do it, you know, on their own. And that's just my comment. I wish I had a question, but it's just a comment. You know, mm-hmm. if we had a baby, we'd leave him in the hospital and say, thanks, there you go. You know, that's it. I'll take a response off the air. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. Bryce, do you hear that a lot? Do you hear, I guess, the subtext that I'm hearing is that due to the economy and the cost of health care, that's actually what might be driving family planning now?
Definitely. We've seen that show up in the numbers, that we've seen women's fertility decline in the recession. We've seen a lot of anecdotes of younger women holding off on having children in such a tough economy. I mean, as we were saying before, it costs a lot to have a child, and there's not a lot of support to help you pay for those costs. So a lot of people, I think, particularly in this economy with such high unemployment, are much more wary about having kids.
And in our last minute here, what do you predict will be the fate of Nancy Pelosi's agenda, or even the idea of a universal child care system?
I don't know that I would say that her agenda is going to be passed today or in the next year or in the next five. But I do think that the idea behind it, that we need to do something with our policies to acknowledge that our families have changed and our workplaces have changed and both parents go to work now, it's one that's going to keep growing. I think that the average American really hears that and gets that now, and it's not controversial for them. It's really just controversial in Congress. And so I think we're going to see movement and momentum. I just don't know how long it's going to take.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Bryce Covert. She writes for The Nation on issues of women and business. KP Whaley produced this program, and Rhonda Fanning provided on-air production. I hope you'll join us on the Ideas Network tomorrow for Science Friday at this time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.